Peter's last official paid gig for the church. So this is your last chance to get your pound of flesh out of Peter. As Marita said, 7 years, at least 70 sermons. Most of us probably at some time or other have done a sermon and done the odd sermon. A couple of people have probably done a normal one, but for those of us that have done the odd one, it's no mean feat. And to think, look back, Pete, and think you've done 70 at least over the last 7 years is a wonderful, wonderful effort and contribution to us. To set the scene for this morning, it really is not meant to be too serious. It could be get serious, but we sort of, when we chatted about it, it's sort of a combination between hard chat, you can't ask me that, and Q&A. So I'm showing my age, we don't watch commercial TV. And it occurred to me about 2 o'clock this morning that what we should have had was invited Bevan to do a portrait of Peter and then it could have been Ando as well. So if you can bundle all that up into one morning, then that this session really is a chance to really chat with Peter, really to be asking him anything we like. So we have had a few questions come through, and so that's good. We've got some starting points. But please, as we go through this morning, please feel free to interject, comment, heckle.
Just behave as you usually do.
Yeah, that's right. So I might just kick it off. I hope not.
It's being recorded for legal reasons.
Peter, they say that we each have one sermon. You know, there's kind of one sermon in us. What was yours?
You missed it, didn't you? If it one sermon? The famous theologian Karl Barth was once asked, he wrote dozens of books and no... Sorry. The famous theologian Karl Barth wrote dozens of books and nobody understood what he was talking about, which was good for other theologians. But he was once asked to summarise everything that he knew and everything that he'd written in one sentence, and he said, "Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so." If I was asked to do exactly the same thing, as I suppose I have been, then I would say, trust and obey, for there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. What did I say for the other 70?
Yes. So what, Peter, what do you want to be remembered for?
Oh dear, I don't know. I'm not even sure I want to be remembered. This might sound a bit serious, but I think I've been thinking about things a lot, and I think that I hope it's true that everyone is looking actually for the same thing. That's you, me, everyone here, Richard Dawkins, Professor Brian Cox, if you know who he is, all scientists, all people like us are actually all looking for the same thing, and that thing is truth. There's a famous French philosopher called André Gide who once said, "Seek the company of those who are looking for the truth, avoid those who claim to have found it," which is very good advice, I think. So I think we're always on a journey looking for truth. Hopefully we are. I think once we get to the point where we say, "Okay, I've got the truth," then unless you're somebody who's in their late teens, I think we're all saying, "Okay, I'm on a journey. I'm trying to find out what truth is." I want to be remembered for saying something like that. Keep looking, keep searching, keep asking questions. Yep, that sort of stuff.
I thought you might have answered, "I could be wrong."
Yes.
And I think that was a nice segue into the corollary of finding the truth.
I thought about having that up on the for the whole of the session, yes.
I could be wrong. Absolutely, Mike.
About where, how you landed at that.
How you, what? Sorry?
How you landed at using that as your starter for every sermon.
How I started? Yeah, sure.
How come you landed on that phrase?
Yeah. On sorry, on the truth. No.
On I could be wrong.
Oh, yeah, sure.
What's the story behind?
Yeah, sure.
I could be wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Right here in this very room, where we used to have various people coming to speak at various times, as we still do, but we invited the then abbot from New Norcia to come, Father Blessed Spirit. And before he started, he handed out bits of paper summarising what he was going to be saying. And at the top of it were the words, I could be wrong. And I just thought, well, you know, that's brilliant. That is so good. That is so right, you know. I have a vision that on the last great day when Jesus returns and all truth is known, that there are going to be millions of us dancing with our arms around each other and we're singing a song and the song goes, we were wrong, we were wrong, we were wrong. yeah. Because I'm sure we are, you know, yeah.
Any other questions? Pete, why does your nose run?
That's a good question. I wasn't expecting that one. I don't know why it is, Graham, but I have taken it as a sign that I'm doing well when my nose starts to run. I don't know why it is. Funnily enough, at Vaux, I met a wonderful guy whose name is Ben. He is a huge man, and he's generally known as Big Ben for that reason. But he preaches regularly, and he has exactly the same experience, that he feels that when he's really, you know, got it happening, his nose starts to run. Yes. Yeah, could be, yes. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't happen all the time. Good. <Yes. laughs> I'd much rather have a runny nose than start crying. Yes, yes, yes. Is that it?
No.
All right.
So this is one that's come from the community. If Jesus was alive today, which Christian denomination would he be a member of?
Well, first, let me make this absolutely clear. He is alive today. So if I could have the name of the person who gave me, put that one down. If there's any doubt about this, you know, I need to see you afterwards. Stop hiding behind your wife's hair. Sorry, what was the rest of the question?
Yeah, that's yeah. Thanks, thanks, Bill. So yeah, so I think in for instance, if he was with us today,
yeah,
which denomination would he be a member of?
He would be horrified. I think he is horrified at denominations. His intention was that all his servants would be one, would be, you know, united. And I think the mistake that we've made over the last 2,000 years, one of the mistakes we've made over the last 2,000 years, is that we think that means we have to agree. I think members of a family don't agree, but they're still members of a family. And I think what we need to do is get to a point where we're listening to each other and not necessarily agreeing, but saying this person is my brother or sister in Christ. You know, we don't agree, but nonetheless, they are my brother and sister in Christ. So I think if Jesus was alive today, he'd get rid of denominations immediately. If he, when he comes back, he's not going to point at one denomination and say, well done, guys, you got it perfectly right. That's not going to happen. Yeah, we've all got it wrong.
But he certainly wouldn't be a Catholic.
See, I grew up in a denomination where that was absolutely right. God could not possibly be even working in the Catholic Church. You know, that it's an appalling way of thinking. One of the things I'm so happy about these days is that we start recognising the depth of spirituality in the Catholic Church, and we pick up on it, we use it. One of the fun things I've done while I've been here was run a two-part series, which was just a video of Henri Nouwen being interviewed by a man with a strange taste in jumpers. I don't know if anybody remembers that. Just the things he had to say were just so blinking brilliant. And also discovered Brother Lawrence. But, you know, the Catholic Church is loaded with wonderful spirituality. So you never know, he might actually, you know. Yep.
Would you agree with my thought based on that we could include Catholic in our name, Mount Hawthorne Community Catholic Church, without the Roman bit, just with the view that we're part of and connected to all?
Put it up, Tony. Put it to suggest it to the next AGM. See what happens.
Hey, Tony, did you read the creed for belonging to the Outpressing Church?
We've already said we've got a public church. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. When I first became an elder in the Presbyterian Church, the pastor of the church, Ian Robinson, who many of you know, said to me, "You have to sign the Westminster Confession. Here it is. Here's a pen. Whatever you do, don't read it." Like a complete and utter buffoon, I did. I didn't read it. I just signed it. And boy, did that come back to haunt me after Ian Robinson went to Sydney and left me as one of the elders in the church. Yeah. So the Westminster Confession of Faith does state that the Pope is the Antichrist.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
Moving right along. So this is one that's come from the community. How does God speak to you, and how can you be sure that it is God speaking?
What a brilliant question. How does God speak to me? Any way he wants to is the simple answer. I am what they call technically a mystic, and a mystic is somebody who believes that they actually have a hotline to God, and that there's a two-way conversation going on. As I said, I grew up in a very conservative evangelical church, and I think very young I was impressed by the story of Samuel, that God spoke to Samuel directly, and I thought, well, that must be how it's supposed to work then. And it wasn't until years later that I found out that the denomination that I was part of really frowned on that kind of thing. As it turned out, so does West Australian Presbyterians really frowned on that kind of thing. You can't have a personal experience of God, is what I was told by during all the troubles by Bruce Fraser. Many of you will remember him. He said the Presbyterian Church doesn't recognise a personal experience of God. You know, if it's in the Bible as interpreted by the Presbyterian Church, then that's how God speaks to you. Fairly late in life, in my 40s, something happened which was I could not have foreseen, and certainly didn't want to happen, was that I started to have visions. I'm just not the kind of person that has visions, but there I was praying, and I saw things, you know, and I thought, this is odd. Ever since then, every now and again, I've had a vision. So it comes back to the old question. You hear God speaking to you. There are two possible explanations for that I've come up with. One is that God really does speak to me, which it means that obviously there is a God. And the other is that I've got some kind of a serious mental illness. I could, yeah. The way I comfort myself is the knowledge that I'm part of community, not just this community, but other communities of Christian people. And there are, in fact, lots and lots of people who have exactly the same experiences that I do, though not so many of them have visions. Therefore, you know, either there is a lot of craziness around, or we are actually onto something. God really is speaking. Andrew.
Visions?
I'll share three. If I can do this really quickly. One was, this started happening in my 40s, and this particular vision was either while I was still living in Canberra and doing policy work, which is what I was doing, or just after we came back. And in the vision, I was just praying, and I suddenly found myself suspended over a river. It was very much a New South Wales Highlands kind of river, fast flowing, you know, with rocky rocks in the bottom of it. And I was drinking from the river. And I suddenly realized that I had all sorts of things to do, meetings to go to, ministerial correspondence to attend to, those kind of things, you know, and started getting quite panicky. And a voice said, all you have to do is drink from the river. So I carried on drinking from the river. And then a few seconds later, again, I was thinking, I've got this submission to write, I've got meetings, you know, I've got this kind of stuff. And the voice said, all you have to do is drink from the river. So I think the message is quite clear. As to what I believe God was saying to me at the time. More recently, and I may have talked about one of these, I've had two visions which have concerned churches. God has really been, I believe, laying stuff on my heart about churches, and basically how churches, denominations, and keeping ourselves in tight little groups is a really, really bad idea and not what he's ever intended at all. The first one... Cut the story short. The actual vision was that I was on the South Downs in England, looking out over England's green and pleasant land, lots of patchwork fields, villages, towns. All the villages and towns had churches in them, and the churches were exploding. No one was getting hurt, but the walls were flying out, the ceilings were flying off, little spires were going up like little rockets. It was very cute. And people were running out of these churches and running to people coming out of other churches and embracing them. And a funny thing, I was telling a lady that I met in another situation about this the other day, and she said that when she was a little girl, she had a dream which had stayed with her, which was she was in a church, and in her church, and the walls collapsed. And she looked out at the space where the walls had been over this rubble, and she could see another church where the walls had collapsed, and the people were coming out, and they were all shaking hands over the top of the rubble. Just this third one, just quickly, was I was looking at a very Australian scene, which was a plain brown plain, absolutely arid plain, nothing growing on it at all, but it was completely covered every few hundred meters there was a dam on this plain. They were circular earth dams, so you know what a dam wall looks like, it's made of earth, but these were actually circular, and they were full of water, and the only thing that was growing was on the rims of these dams, green grass was growing. There was nothing else growing on the plain at all, but God was going around, pulling the walls of the dams down, kicking holes in them, and the water was flowing out of the dams and across the plain. So again, I think the message is clear. The important thing about both those last two is that God was doing it. If it happens one day and it comes, and I pray and hope that it does, those things do happen, it's God that's going to do it. Nobody's going to be able to say, I started that, you know, or that was my denomination that did it. Was that fun? Am I crazy? Oh, good. Initially, curiosity was the dominant one. When it first happened, I thought, "What the is going on here?" And at one stage, because I had several in very rapid succession when they started, I was praying and I suddenly saw something and I thought, "I wonder if I can manipulate this." You know, is this just me that's doing this somewhere deep in my subconscious, which must be a pretty interesting place? I've never been there, of course, but I'm sure it is interesting. Is it just me? Is it just coming? So I tried to manipulate it and gone. Just stopped immediately. Yeah. Go on.
Curiosity doesn't sound like an emotion. Maybe it is. Okay. I was just wondering what feelings they gave you to see that.
There was no emotion in terms of a positive or a negative emotion. There was no fear, no joy, no sense of isn't this wonderful? You know, I'm one of those people who has visions. No, I can't think of an emotion apart from just sort of. This is interesting. Yeah. She really does have eyes in the back of her head.
Peter, something that has always astounded me about you, you said you never read books.
Yep.
And yet you've gone this route of preaching and learning and doing a PhD now.
Yep.
Now, I've always been astounded that you never read books. You didn't brag about it, but you stated that.
Yep.
And yet you're such an intellectual.
I'm what? I'm sorry, I missed that last bit.
And yet you're such an intellectual.
Yep.
Can you explain
that? I'll take that one, yeah. Can I explain it? Yes. What a wonderful question, Bevan. I love this one. Okay, reading and writing was invented by human beings in the same way that they invented the wheel or the mobile phone or anything in between. Reading and writing was invented by human beings, and I've done quite a lot of research on this. It started more or less around 4000 AD in the Middle East. Leave China out of it, but more or less 4000 AD in the Middle East. Sorry. Yes, I do mean BC. Yeah. I do. Yeah, absolutely. I do mean BC. Thank you. I'm glad you're here. It didn't get to the point. It didn't develop to the point where people could write down stories or histories or laws or that kind of thing up until about 1500 BC, which is the earliest date possible for Moses. So that's really interesting, I think. So the whole of Genesis. Every story in Genesis was written before there was reading and writing. If you look for the words reading and writing in Genesis, you just won't find them. They're not there. So what we have in Genesis is oral stories which were passed down and then were eventually written down. Funnily enough, even though mankind hadn't invented reading and writing, God was perfectly capable of interacting with human beings. I think that's extremely important, and I don't think God changed. So I don't think that being a Christian, let's put it that another way. I don't think that having a right relationship with God, shall we say, is in any way dependent on being able to read or on having books of any kind. This is where we might be getting into some interesting conversations. It just cannot be. You know, this isn't the way God planned things. We invented reading and writing. Now, as to terms of my own reading books, I have read lots of books. They've almost all been novels. I have real trouble reading books which are non-fiction. I just get bored, and it almost doesn't matter what the book is. Biography, sometimes, if it's somebody I'm really interested in, I will read it. But yes, I did get through all these years at Vos and through a master's. I've got a master's degree, and as I was saying to Brian Harris, the principal of Vos, that I had actually done that, including all the book reviews that you have to do as part of that, without actually reading a book, cover to cover. Well, okay, so you've got an assignment. One thing I've learned through all this is God doesn't care very much about human rules. He wants me to have a master's. I don't know why. He wants me to have a master's, and there are a lot of the things which you should do in order to get a master's, I actually didn't do. When I told Brian Harris this, he said, just don't speak so loudly, is what he said to me. How do you write an assignment? You know, you've got an assignment to write, you understand what the question is, you go to the library, you pick a book out, you look in the index. Does it talk about the topic of the assignment? Okay, well, you go and read that bit then. Looking at the end of chapters where there tends to be a synopsis is always a good thing to do, I've found. But, you know, I knew lots of students who, when they had a reading list for a particular assignment, would actually go out and read all the books. Surely there are better things to do. But going back to that point, Christianity has become something which is so book-focused that it's nuts. And this is the devil's work. It has to be the devil's work. So, you know, people who like books find it fine to be part of a Christian church. People who don't like books and are prepared to stand up and say, you know, I don't read books, may just find, you know, so often you talk to somebody and they say, oh, I've read a really good book on that. Here you are, you know, that's a really good book. Am I making sense? We cannot have a if we're followers of the teachings of Jesus, we cannot have a, what's a better word for than religion, I don't know, a way of living which is so, which is only accessible by people like us, educated, middle class, people like that. That cannot be the way God's intended it. In fact, the way Jesus talks, he is always in trouble for hanging out with probably people who couldn't read at all. So it's not about reading and writing. It's all about prayer, as far as I'm concerned. And anybody can learn to pray. Now, here's something which I've said out loud at Vaux when I was preaching there at chapel one day. Never have I heard such a deafening silence. Jesus talked to his disciples a lot about prayer and encouraged them to pray and gave them parables about prayer and the importance of prayer and how they should keep praying. He also talked a lot about humility, service, and set himself up as the example of humble service. So Jesus talked about those things a lot. How often did he encourage his disciples to study Scripture? Never. Not once. Zero. Why is that? I'll leave that with you.
Probably, thanks, Peter. Segues into, and not to get you wound up, but...
am I getting wound up?
You wind yourself up, but... is there any point to theology?
There are actually two forms of theology, systematic theology and biblical theology, and I would
Rita
say...
Rita just went like that.
You don't want to ask that? I've got 5 minutes. Oh, 5 minutes to answer that question, or 5 minutes. Yeah.
5 minutes or
less. Oh, dear. Okay. Rightio. I have challenged theologians on occasions. Let's say theology has been running for about 1,800 years. That's about right. I have challenged theologians on occasions. I mean, you know, some serious theologians I'm talking about, to tell me... one truth that has been discovered through theology in that 1,800 years, something that we didn't know before that. I don't recall anyone actually coming up with an answer to that question. A couple of things about theology that I'm always saying. One is that it's the devil's strategy for making sure that an awful lot of Christianity's finest minds, and I do mean that, really brilliant people spend almost all of their time doing something which is almost completely useless. And the other thing I've said is that theology is a bit like panning for gold. You have to work your way through an awful lot of worthless mud in order to see one bright or two bright flecks which are going to make you very slightly richer. Very slightly richer. How am I doing?
Very well.
Thank you.
So, Peter, sort of getting towards the... kind of wrap up, I suppose, but so I'm sure this, I remember back to when you were considering, you know, when we had a teaching role and you felt called to it, and here we are sort of 7 years on, so how's and quirkily that you know one of the issues that came up 7 years ago was yes, we want Peter to do it, but there was this sort of rider that you did go to.
That I had to go and study theology.
You had to go theology.
That's why I was raising my eyebrows at you earlier.
And I remember...
It wasn't my idea.
Initially, you were sort of at your wits' end with Vaux and what was going on. And you know, here you are, you've gone on and done a master's and you've become very involved in Vaux and very engaged in Vaux. And we've had the benefit of the people that you've met and been able to come and talk to us. So we have people like Brian Harris... probably, you know, one of the best speakers you could ever get. So we've really, I think, enjoyed and benefited from those contacts. But quirkily, you know, you've become very involved in the Vaux life. So the question probably, you know, sort of in a wrap-up kind of way is this preaching journey, how's it been? You know, what
the preaching or the Vaux?
Well, it's a package. You know, this journey that God's had you on for since you took up this role, it's evolved. And
as far as Vaux is concerned, Glenn Brooks summed it up when I told him that I'd enrolled at Vaux. He said, "Peter," he said, "you're going to have a wonderful time, and it will drive you crazy." And he was absolutely right. Three times I think I walked out simply because it was crazy. It was just stupid. Jesus left us with a very, very good system for how we, how people grow and develop and learn. And it's called discipleship. And we've got everything that we need to operate through discipleship. So going through the medieval tertiary education system to train people using exams, lectures, assignments, degrees, those kind of things, I think is just totally going against what Jesus gave us. But the question was also about preaching, wasn't it? Stressful at times, very stressful. Which is one of the reasons. I'm standing down because this is the right time to stand down. I'm absolutely certain of that. But stress has been part of that. I don't know. I've always said it's the job that I didn't want. I never actually wanted it. I felt, yes, God wanted me to put my hand up for it. That was all. You may remember that I put my hand up for it. 50, 60 people said, you? Everyone started busily looking for other candidates. And after a few months, there weren't any other candidates. And after a bit more time, there still weren't any other candidates. So the church said, okay, how about a one-year contract? Well, that suited me fine. You know, one-year contract while we look for somebody who knows what they're doing. That'd be great. Here we are. One of the great things, though, about preaching is that you have to spend time studying what you're going to preach. And that is just, and I know almost everybody I know, in fact, probably everybody I know who does preach regularly agrees with this, or who has preached, that you have to spend the time studying it and praying about it, and you find stuff, which you didn't know about, and just being having to put your head into the books, and read about what you're doing and pray about it and reflect on it is just an absolute blessing. It's been great, that bit of it. Being part of a community like this one has made it much easier, and getting into the whole Q&A thing has been very good, because I actually learn in discussion. I don't learn listening to a lecturer or a speaker. I learn best talking to people. So those bits have been an absolute joy for me. Shall I ramble on? No.
No, I think that's great.
Can I ask, does anyone else recall Peter's appointment the same way he does? Because I don't recall it the same way.
No?
And I just felt like I needed to say, that's not how I feel it happened.
Go on.
Well, I was still very new. So I guess I just was very aware that we had a gap in speakers. And you were there and you did that job. And it was great for our church. I didn't want to leave that, because I don't think anyone in the church sees it that way.
So, right. Okay.
Yes, I'd like to say I agree, and my recollection is that, Peter, you put up your hand and people were surprised because they didn't expect you to agree to something like that, and the waiting was more that you knew you didn't really want it, so we're waiting to see if somebody else who wanted it said, yes, please, me.
That's fair, yeah. Michael, you were part of the whole business, yes?
I think I was part of the eldership group at that point, because I know I was part of developing the job description, and you offered to write the job description.
Yes.
And it reflected a real a deliberate shift away from, we don't just someone to teach, we want someone to help develop the learning of the community. And you wrote that job description, and as a bunch of elders, we said, that's exactly what we want. We don't just want to replace, like Glenn Brooks, just teaching all the time, but someone who will help us learn together. And you wrote that job description, and then I think slightly sheepishly, you then said, oh, I think I meant to apply for that job. And my recollection was, maybe it took a bit of time, but there was a really strong sense on the eldership that you were the right person to have a go at this. Slightly idiosyncratic because you wrote the job description you're going to get. But my sense is that there was a strong sense of this feels right to us.
Yeah.
And maybe it was only for a year initially, but that would be quite normal for a contract job. But it evolved from there, that sense that this is the new kind of right direction for the teaching and learning. And yes, slightly odd that you wrote the job description and we're going to appoint you, but it felt right.
Mm. Very good. Well, I think that's... Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the last 7 years.
Time flies when you're getting old, don't
thank you. Yeah, sure.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, Peter. I think you taking on this role has been very beneficial for the church, but I think it's been very beneficial for you. And I think for me, the bit that I think is how God works is that you don't like books and you don't like the theology and you don't, and yet you're so engrossed in both, and I think that's God, you know, that's yes. Just lovely. Absolutely. That and for all the kicking and screaming that it took to sort of you to get engrossed in that, involved in that world, in that academic world, is that's God, you know, that's God. And we've benefited from that involvement, and I think you have too. So we look forward to the future, and we thank you for what you've done. Mm. We thank you wholeheartedly. Yeah.
Next sermon. All right. Yes. Good. Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
It takes somebody who doesn't like the status quo to cause a stir and create something better.
Yeah. And in terms of theology, it's best done from the inside. If you're outside and you don't have the degrees and you say, this is a load of rubbish, this isn't what Jesus intended at all, nobody's going to take any notice. But if you're inside and you do have the degrees, then, yeah. Sorry.
Good work.
Okay, a big clap.